Okay, here we are, February 8, 2009, lecture discussion number 79. Wow, on Genesis 1 through 19. Okay, we left off last week rushing through Joshua chapter 3 and Joshua chapter 4. And we were rushing because of the urgency of securing Kentucky Fried Chicken for the high religious holiday that was on the precipice. And I was, I have to admit, this 1 hour later start time was a big impact. It did indeed place a strain on the food gathering. Usually I have more time, and we can beat, for example, the Presbyterians to Kentucky Fried Chicken, but this year, they were there ahead of me. There's serious competition for Super Bowl essentials, you know. And the procurement process is fraught with peril. And fortunately, I am a grizzled veteran of these things. And I know the traps that swallow up the less experienced. First rule of Kentucky Fried Chicken. Everyone should know this. What's the first rule of Kentucky Fried Chicken? Yeah, never confuse the counter person. Just don't. Don't even think about it. They're already, when I walked in there, there's probably 35 people sitting in there. And they're packed in. And there's five counter people, and they're all disheveled, and, you know, their eyes are, well, they're just, they're the walking dead. And you never confuse the counter person. No extras. No, whatever you do, no extras. Don't change a thing. No coleslaw, no extra crispy, no biscuits, no sodas, no JoJo's. Don't even think about it. You'll still be there. There's still people there waiting for that. You go in, you say original recipe, put it in a bucket. You ask for mashed potatoes. They say, would you like another side? You say, yes, mashed potatoes. And then you want gravy, so all you get, original recipe, mashed potatoes, gravy, bam, you're gone. There was at least 10 people ahead of me. There was a bunch of people hanging around out there. And I get to the counter, I get my original recipe, mashed potatoes, mashed potatoes, mashed potatoes, gravy, 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 gone. Pow. And they're waiting for their teriyaki buffalo wings, half hour, 45 minutes. And they're in awe of me. They are. And they ask. I'm in and out 2 minutes. And they ask, who was that guy? How did he do that? The shadow, maybe? No. The flash? Nope. As I'm driving away, I think I need a name. I know I need theme music. But I think I need a name. I think of a whole bunch of names. King of Chicken Picking, I think. No. Chicken a la King, I'm thinking. No. Next year, as I said, theme music, a cape, a sidekick. I need a sidekick. Okay, enough of that. Where were we? The list. Last week's list. That's what we did last week. And many of you, as you should, you began to dissect and evaluate the key components of this. This is Joshua 3:14 to 4:24 diagrammed out, and you began to evaluate it and start to separate it, rightfully searching for the person and or work of Jesus Christ. And let me repeat that word again. Rightfully searching, searching. John 5:39, this is what Christ says. I think it's a command. Search the Scriptures. These are they that testify of me. What Scriptures is he talking about? There is no New Testament. He says, search the Old Testament. The purpose of the Old Testament is to testify of me. So we should always search for Christ when reading the Old Testament. To do otherwise, you hear me say it all the time, I'll say it again, I don't see any visitors, I won't offend anybody. To do otherwise in the Old Testament, to not search for Christ is to fail. The theme, the purpose of the Old Testament is to testify of Jesus Christ, period. And I believe that this is a command. This is not something that we're to do if we feel like it. We are to always do it. No other approach in the Old Testament is valid but the John 5:39 approach. And many of you began quickly searching through last Sunday's list. Good for you. And you began to look at each and every one of them as if they were what? As if they are Christ. Now, some are, some aren't. But find Christ. Search the Scriptures. They testify of Him. Now, if you were unable to attend last week, perhaps because you were, say, maybe mired, ensnared in a line pleading for your coleslaw, and you missed church, I want you to consider, imagine for a minute, the frailty of your excuse, though. How feeble it is. How unsubstantial. I do not have to worry about that, because original mashed potatoes, mashed potatoes, mashed potatoes, gravy, 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 go on. I wouldn't want your excuse standing before the magistrate. But let's imagine that you missed church, or some of you did. I know you did. It was a high religious holiday. And by the way, the people that came last week that aren't here today, or what? They're saying, hey, I came on a high religious holiday. I can take a couple of Sundays off. That's what they did. They do it. I know they do it. You know, that's the sad thing, by the way, and just on a serious note. What kills little churches like us, kills them every time, is what? Inconsistent attendance, yeah. That's what kills us. What happens is, and I'll never forget the day we had about, well, we were going to start the service, and now I'm off on a tangent completely. Right, we're going to start the service, and it was 11:30, and we might have had four or five people here. And we had a lady that came and sat right where Ben is. And she sat for 3 minutes and got up and left. Because she was scared. And if anybody came in here today, they would be scared. There's no question about it. Because it seems like there's something wrong. You can't help but think that when no one's coming. And so when you come late or you don't come consistently, you crush the morale. And you are all innocent of this, by the way. This is for those who aren't here. But when you come late, or you come in consistently, you crush the morale of a small church. That's what's killing them all over the country. And the big churches know that. And they know that they can destroy the small church by peeling off their people. And it's happening in the city. It's happened in the city for a long time. It'll continue to happen. It's just how it goes. The only people that are unaffected by it are the ethnic groups that bond together because of ethnicity. They're not affected by the competition. But we are. And it's not happening just to us, by the way. I go to meetings on Tuesdays where there's great despair and wailing and gnashing of teeth because of the dying out of the small church in the city of Anchorage. Okay, that's enough happy talk. But if you weren't here last week, I'll accept your unexcused absence. It's a loss of a letter grade, but we'll help you catch up today. Joshua 3:4 is a very complex portrait of Jesus Christ. As you know, as you should always think, it is a very complex portrait of Jesus Christ entering first ahead of His people, entering alone ahead of His people into the Jordan River. Now, you're going to say to me He's carried on poles by the priests, but the ark goes first alone into the Jordan River. He is typified by the Ark of the Covenant, or the Ark of the Testimony. Start saying Ark of the Testimony. I know you're battling the movie, right? But it's really Ark of the Testimony. He is typified by the Ark of the Testimony carried on the poles by the priests ahead of the children of Israel. And the Jordan River is raised in a heap as soon as the Ark begins to enter the river. It says as soon as the priests their feet dip into the water, the Jordan River is raised in a heap far away at Adam. Far away at Adam, raised in a heap. Now, there's a lot of debate over what raised in a heap far away at Adam means. What do you think it means? Adam, by the way, a good city of Adam. But don't start thinking city. I leave the city of Adam out just because I want you to see that the Jordan River is raised in a heap. Dammed up, if you will, at Adam. Whoosh. 15 miles away. Minimum. Maybe 20 miles away from where they entered the ark. Where the ark entered. Some think that the river fled back all the way to Adam. Some say, no, I have a situation like this. Oh, I'm out of room to
I'll put it over here. I have the water all of a sudden dams up at Adam. And so I have water between the ark now and water going into the Dead Sea, this being the spot. So I have three waters to deal with. Obviously, the waters going into the Dead Sea disappear rather quickly, wouldn't they? Boom, they'd be gone. What about this secondary water? Did it flee back up to Adam, become part of the dam, or was it dammed up again at the crossing of the Jordan River? Number one view is? What's that? No, that's number two view. Number one view is that I have a dam at Adam, and then I have another dam at the crossing of the Red Sea. Number one view. Know that there are two. By the way, the ark is missing from the list. It's here. Oh, no, it's not. I have it right there in number one. Good for me. When I wrote it down, I didn't put it in here. Let me see. Did I think I made a mistake? And not really? Oh, wrong. I have it at home. I have to wait at home to see if I made a mistake. Let's rush, dear. Okay. Oh, buffet after the service. That's an announcement. I see. Let me count them. 1, 2 crock pots. That's always good news. Okay, something covered up, some mystery dish covered up in a towel. Something in a box. I do not see dessert. Oh, pie. Oh, good for us. Okay. Don't let anybody else in. Lock the doors. That'll work. We call that seeker sensitive, don't we? Okay. Okay. The Jordan River raised in a heap far away at Adam. In other words, Adam is far away from the ark, isn't it? The ark is Christ. Adam is far away from Christ. Or what Adam is representing. Okay? Then the ark is moved to the dry ground in the midst of the Jordan River. In other words, I have now dry ground, the feet dipped, I got dry ground, I got a dam here, I got a dam back up in Adam, number one view. Then we walk into the Jordan River and the ark is standing on dry ground held by the priests. And it is a very heavy symbol. And then eventually we have the come up, right? Command, come up. God says come a lot. He says come up sometimes at a couple of very key places. And so what people do that study this, they begin to put together all the comes and all the come ups and relate them together. Anyway, Jesus Christ then will have the law inside him is what the ark is a primary symbol of. The primary symbol, the ark, is Jesus Christ will be alone in the river on dry ground. He will cause the river to heap up and to drain away, and he will be in dry ground, and his blood will be covering the law over the mercy seat that is inside the ark. That is the primary symbol. He will be the first fruits of those who go into this river. He will be the first fruits of those who come up. Right? So he is the first fruits. First fruits, by the way, is resurrection feast day, isn't it? The feast day of first fruits is the resurrection day. Resurrection being prominent here. He alone will deal with the death that is symbolized by the Jordan River. He alone stands in the midst of the death and the judgment. He has authority of it, over it. He can make it do whatever he wants. He alone performs this. This work of redemption, John 13:36. I have a note. Explain John 13:36. I don't think I will today. Maybe we'll get back to it. The redeemed by faith pass through death and judgment on dry ground because the ark goes first and is alone there and causes the heaping up and the draining away and the dry ground to be there. And so we pass through safely, those of us who pass through, those of us who see him in the river, those of us who want to pass through on dry ground. How much fear do we have? How much fear did they have? Okay, we're going to make that decision here in a minute because we're going to compare what they did, this generation, with the other generation. But there is the primary truth of the ark going into the waters and they're rising up in a heap. It is clearly a reference to Christ's work with regard to entering death, sin, and judgment for the sake of our resurrection, which follows His. But really not for that at all, is it? It's for His glory. That's the difference, by the way, between dispensationalism and covenantism. Did you know? Anybody care? Well, I do. It's kind of how weird I am. Dispensationalism says that the purpose of Scripture is to glorify Christ. Covenantism has a tendency to say that the purpose of Scripture is to explain our salvation. One of them is Christ-centered, the other one is man-centered. Oops. That's an easy shot for me. The dispensationalist word glorifies God primarily. We are saved. Our salvation is a secondary element. If that. That's the difference. Okay. One difference. There are other differences, but that's the one I always... That's where I go first. It's like arguing with the evolutionists. I always go to cessation of existence. When I argue with a covenant-based theologian, I always go to glory of God. Okay, but there's more to all of this. As you know, there's always more. This is a pretty big list. There are the 2 12 stone memorials. I have J, and I have, where's the other one? R. I have 2 12 stone memorials. One that remains in place in the Jordan River where the ark went across, where the ark stood. So where the ark was standing, this picture of Christ, the symbol of Christ, where it was exactly a 12 stone memorial was erected. And then, of course, the waters came back over. But that memorial at the time of Joshua still remained. One that remains in the place in the Jordan River and the other one near Jericho at Gilgal. Where do I have Gilgal on here? I hope I do. I don't. That's not a mistake yet. It's never a mistake if you can fix it. So, here's how we do it. There. Okay, so I have a 12-stone memorial a mile or a quarter, 2 miles or so away from Jericho on the other side, and I have a 12-stone memorial or sign, if you will, the sign of the 12 stones at the place where the ark was. And so we ask, what is the meaning of these two memorials, these signs? What is the answer, or what are the answers to the two questions? Note that I have question number one. Where is question number one? Children ask question number one. I have question number two. So L and S, they ask him, and T, they answer. What is the meaning of the two memorials? What are the answers to the two questions the children ask? Why is this a memorial forever? Forever seems to be a long time. It's a memorial forever. Why is it forever? Well, it's forever for obvious reasons. What is the obvious reason the word forever is attached to these signs? Or this sign, these memorials? What's the reason? Yes, that's right. It's an eternal sign. Therefore, it has to be about Jesus Christ. So these stones in these places are pictures of Christ. Let's go ahead and read that together so you get it a little bit stronger. Joshua 4. Verse 7. And we'll compare the difference between do I have that down here? Make sure. Let's read all of that. just for fun. Joshua 4:7. Then, see, we'll start at 6. That this may be a sign among you when your children ask in time to come, saying, what do these stones mean to you? Then you shall answer them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord when it crossed over the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan were cut off, and these stones shall be a memorial to the children of Israel forever. Now go Joshua 4:21. Then he spoke to the children of Israel, saying, when your children ask their father in time to come, what are these stones? Then you shall let your children know. Israel crossed over this Jordan on dry land, for the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you had crossed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea. So in other words, start doing what? Start comparing the Red Sea to the Jordan River, which he dried up before us until we had crossed over, that all the peoples of the earth may know the hand of the Lord that is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. This is something that will be forever. But note the differences between the two questions. Did you notice that? What do these stones mean? And what are these stones? What do these stones mean, and what are these stones? What's the difference? What's the difference between those questions? See, now to me, the answer is obvious, at least to the second question. What are these stones? It should probably be reworded differently. What are these stones? I'll reword it differently for you. Who are these stones? Or what do these stones represent? Or who do these stones represent? The stones are symbols of Jesus Christ. You know that because they're memorials forever. Now, how exactly they memorialize him forever is another task to complete. And again, for those who were especially holy last week, which means you were here, I gave you what I thought was the obvious solution to all of this, which is circumcision. That's right. Good for you. Just in case you think everyone sleeps through the sermon like you, it isn't true, is it? There's evidence right there. See, I propose a solution to this is Joshua chapter 5, circumcision. As with 2 Kings 5, I said, if you remember, in 2 Kings 6, they are two parts to a whole. Naaman's leprosy is explained, complemented by the floating iron axe head. Joshua 4, the memorial stones, the ark in the midst of the Jordan, is complemented, is explained by Joshua 5, which is circumcision. And whenever I say circumcision to you, you always say back to me, Moses and Zipporah. You always say Moses and Zipporah because it is a stumbling block to Zipporah. It represents Israel, so therefore we get into the stumbling block of Israel, which is what? Christ crucified. So whenever you see circumcision, you say Christ crucified. That will help you always understand circumcision. It is a symbol for Christ crucified. What is the sign of circumcision attached to? Abrahamic covenant. What therefore is the sign of the Abrahamic covenant? Christ crucified, symbolized by circumcision. You are a husband of blood to me. Okay? That becomes obvious, by the way, in Joshua 5:1. All you got to do to see that Joshua 5 is going to explain Joshua 4 is just read Joshua 5:1. Before we read that, though, remember that the New Testament will explain the Old Testament. We should always remember that. There's a little clever saying. It's kind of a poem. Does anybody know it? The New Testament, I wish I memorized it, but it's been in American culture for generations. It comes back from the 1600s. The Old Testament is something in the New Testament, da-da-da-da. Nobody know that? Yes. Yes, there's explained in it. It's really good. I mean, it's very ancient. They're not very ancient. It's 300-400 years, but it's wonderful. It could be it. Or vice versa. That's right. We can't be expected to remember things. But always try to understand that the New Testament explains the Old Testament. So if I have an Old Testament problem, I go into the New Testament to find a New Testament solution to it. So if I'm going to look in Matthew or Joshua 4 and try to figure out, you know, if I don't know anything about it, I don't know anything about Joshua 4. I don't know anything about typology. I don't know to search the Old Testament to find pictures of Christ. I'm just an absolute neophyte at Scripture. I should at least know that there's going to be something in the New Testament that explains what happened in Joshua 4. And the New Testament complement you've heard me say, and I should put it on the board, is Matthew 3:16. Matthew 3:16 is the baptism of Christ. Okay, Joshua 5:1. So it was, when all the kings of the Amorites who were on the west side of the Jordan, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, this is an odd place to put this, but I'm listening to the former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, explain the Washington Monument. Did anybody see that? Yeah, it's incredible, the people who built the Washington Monument. They made sure that it faced east, so that what? So that when Christ came, it'd be the first thing he saw in Washington. And what's written on the Washington Monument? Praise God. They wanted Jesus Christ, when he returned, to see the height. Nothing is allowed to be higher than the Washington Monument. It's by statute. You cannot build a building taller than the Washington Monument in Washington. And so the first thing Christ would see when he came into the capital of the United States is praise God from the east. Now that's your founding fathers. Good for them, huh? They got it right, didn't they? Gingrich said something very interesting that he quoted Washington. I wish I had it memorized, and I'll have to spend more time studying these guys. I just don't have time. But Washington essentially said, a country that forgets God is lost. And the whole purpose of our country is founded on Scripture, in spite of what the popular culture will tell you. They did not see an evolving constitution. They saw a scriptural constitution. Freedom is based on God. So it was, when all the kings of the Amorites who were on the west side of the Jordan and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan from before the children of Israel until we had crossed over, that their heart melted and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the children of Israel. Okay, obvious question number one right here. This, like I said, this is going to explain a great deal of what's going on. Joshua 4, complemented by Joshua 5, circumcision. Obvious question number one. How is it that the kings of the Amorites heard about the crossing of the Jordan River? So begin to think about that a second. What's the anatomy? What's the process of them hearing? They heard about it. So, obvious question number two. Who told them? Clearly, the Israelites were being what? They were being watched by what? By advanced scouting. By guys with video cameras, right? Okay, no. Obviously, the military of the enemy of the Amorites and the Canaanites knew this massive army was coming towards them and expected an imminent attack, and they did what all armies did. They had an advanced scouting system. And they weren't too worried. Why weren't they worried? How are they going to get across this swollen river? They ain't going to get across that river. We got time. So what do we got to get? Why aren't we massing our army if I'm the Amorites? I got to know where they're coming. They'd go anywhere on that river, right? I mean, it'd be really bad. You know, that's a big river. And it's wide. It could be as much as a mile wide. It's very deep at this time. It's swollen from the rains, right? God picked this particular time on purpose. How come he picked this particular time? Is it because the river is swollen? No. That just happens to be the case. How come he picked this particular time? It's the 10th day of the first month. That's correct. Or the 7th month, depending on it's a religious or the civil calendar. You ever done your religious civil calendar extrapolations yet? No, you're just hoping it never comes up on the test, I know. But it could, couldn't it? Okay, I have a swollen river, and the Israelites, they're going to pick a good spot, aren't they? So the scouts are going to figure out which spot they're going to cross at. How many spots they're going to cross at. And then they're going to go back and mobilize. And they got time because you're not going to cross that river very fast. First off, you're going to have boats with you. You have to build some kind of rafting system. And then what are you really going to have to do? Defend it. You're going to have to defend it. And you're going to have snipers everywhere, aren't you? Consider for a second the scout now, after the ark goes in and the waters heap up and drain away. A bunch of people go across in 15 minutes, whatever they do. It's going to be longer than that. There are a lot of people there. But consider for a second the scout who was given the task of explaining this to the king. Okay, think about that. And the king, by the way, who can now be described after it's reported, as very afraid. So we would call him a what? A chicken king. That's right, we would. A chicken king. How long did it take me to set that up? I mean, don't do this at home. This is a professional here in front of you. You got to work on it. All that time going to Chicken King. Just think of the thought and the setup and the planning that joke took. I mean, just, I want you to be impressed. I am. I worked on it for a long time. And I'm so impressed that Dave got it. Bang, bang, bang. The rest of you, I'm a little worried about you. But anyway. I want you to think about the scout, though, who has got this report to give back. Because they are anticipating Israel being stopped by this flooded barrier, not going to get across it. We've got time to mobilize. We've got time to figure out how to counterattack once they start setting up. Our ability to attack them increases significantly. They have boats, don't they? Because they got to deal with this river all the time. They have a way of getting across it. They know what to do. This marching army that comes in has none of those resources, none of that expertise. And so they could attack them all kinds of different ways. So I want you to visualize the scouting report, as it said, and I kind of made a short one. King. Chicken King. Chicken a la King. Huge army is coming, as we all know. Our plan to mass at the river, once we determine their crossing points, our plan to pin them down in the river, pick them off as they cross, ain't gonna happen. They came across very, very quickly. He's gonna say, how is that possible? And they're gonna say, well, and do you think he went by himself? No, he needed witnesses for this. Here's how they did it. The waters rose up in a heap. They have this box. As soon as the box starts to go in the river, and the box is covered with a bunch of skins, we can't even tell what it is. But as soon as the box goes into it, because every time you move that box, right, it's got to be covered. It's got to be hidden. As it moves within the community of Israel, as it moves within that land, it is hidden. It is covered in what? Skin, flesh, that's right. Where'd they get the skins? They're from dolphins and porpoises. Where'd they get them? Red Sea, that's right. So anyway, they got it covered. And he said, we got a box. They put the box in the river. Priests are carrying it on poles. They're lifting it. Can't put it on a wagon. Can't roll it. You got to carry it on a pole. Yes. Okay. They got this ark thing, and when they move it into the water, it controls the water. It raises it up in a heap. It has authority over all this water, and they came across very fast. Just in case you thought that Red Sea thing was a fluke, it wasn't a fluke. This is again, they crossed that river already. They, by the way, stopped to build two stone towers, or they'd be here by now, and you'd be dead. But they stopped to build two stone towers, and Joshua gives a speech to everybody, and then they circumcised themselves. And they're an hour, or they're a mile and a quarter away from Jericho. Judgment is coming. The sin of the Canaanites has come full. Time has run out, and fear and trembling is here. Okay. Remember, the purpose of this today is to figure out, to answer these two questions. What is it that these things mean? What is the sign of the 12 stones? Now, right now, this is the place, the opportune time and place, to insert the comparison of the Red Sea crossing with the Jordan River crossing. Again, you have to do that because of verse 23. As the Lord your God did to the Red Sea. Two generations now have come through water like this. There's two crossings. One was the circumcised group. That's the first generation. They were circumcised. This was an uncircumcised group that came through. They weren't circumcised until after they came across this river. And we probably should read that, so let's do that. Now we're at Joshua 5:2. Okay, are you there? I hope you are. So they crossed over the Jordan River. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, go Zipporah here. Grab a bunch of rocks. Let's start circumcising everybody. Just imagine that for a second. Now, we're going to put in the symbol Christ crucified right here. We got through the Red Sea, and we're going to put through the symbol of Christ crucified. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives for yourselves. Why not use iron knives? Why do we have to? How sharp do you think a rock knife is? You know, I mean, you can make them pretty sharp. But that's not my first choice. I'm going, you know, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm definitely not hoping it's a rock knife. Point is, yeah, Bill's correct. You can make them really sharp, and they did. You have to, but God wants a flint knife. I made Avril laugh. That's probably my number one time. Or did you? I wanted credit for it, whatever the case may be. People have noticed that I'm losing my serious tone, aren't they? That's happened now 4 or 5 weeks in a row. It isn't lack of sleep anymore. At the time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives for yourself and circumcise the sons of Israel again the second time. Not these people the second time. This is the second time the nation of Israel goes through circumcision. So Joshua makes flint knives for himself and circumcised the sons of Israel at the hill of the foreskins. There you go. That must have been quite a sight. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt who were males, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. I'll say it another way. After they had crossed through the Red Sea. For all the people who came out, let me read that again. All the people who came out, and you immediately go, item P, all the people who had came up, if you will, all the people who had came out had been circumcised, but all the people born in the wilderness on the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. For the children, why hadn't they been circumcised? You would think they'd be circumcised, but they clearly weren't, were they? I come out of the Red Sea and I go into the wilderness for 40 years and we got lots of children. Everybody that came out of the Red Sea was circumcised. And they're all what? Dead. In the wilderness. And they didn't circumcise their sons. Why not? For the children of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness till all the people who were men of war, who came out of Egypt, were consumed because they did not obey the voice of the Lord, to whom the Lord swore that he would not show them the land which the Lord had sworn to their fathers, that he would give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. Then Joshua circumcised their sons whom he raised up in their place, for they were uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised on the way. So it was when the people had finished circumcising all the people. How much circumcising have we got going here? Well, we got a hill of foreskins. We got a whole bunch of circumcising going on. What's chapter 5 all about? Circumcision. Can't get any more secret sensitive than a hill of foreskins, can you? I mean, you can't. But it's about circumcision. It just pounds you with circumcision, doesn't it? It's all, everything, circumcision, circumcision. It's all it's about. Why? Because it explains Joshua 4 and the sign of the 12 stones. So it was when they had finished circumcising all the people that they stayed in their places in the camp until they were healed. So you can imagine the king. We're dead. They come across the river in 20 minutes. There's a billion of them. They got a box that controls water. We're all going to die. Whoa. They're circumcising themselves. Why don't you attack? Hey, has that happened before, by the way? Yes, it has. Has it happened to them? Yes, it has. The Gibeonites would remember this story at Shechem, wouldn't they? I had a whole bunch of people being circumcised. I'd take them babies out. Would that be justice? Sure seemed like it to the remaining descendants of the ones that were slaughtered by Levi and Simeon at Shechem. That's a wonderful question, by the way. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "This day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. Therefore the name of the place is called Gilgal to this day." So we're putting stones in a place because why? The phone's ringing. Who could be calling us now? I just really want to know. I do. I can, where do you suppose there's another church in Anchorage that during the sermon somebody is calling? It's your message. We can listen to see. She loves hearing her voice over them, don't you? No, she doesn't. Did you answer, Amanda, to see who it was? They're learning the service time right now. It's a person. We'll wait a few more seconds. Holy mackerel, I just sometimes I think I've seen it all and I haven't. Okay, now the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho. So what did you just now learn? Passover. Passover is involved in this. Okay, let's very quickly contrast and compare between the Red Sea and the Jordan River. First, the Red Sea ended, and I'll just do it very fast, we have to. First, the Red Sea ended the generation that came out of Egypt, that first generation, as God counts. He calls that generation that came out of Egypt the first generation. It ended their bondage to Egypt. That was the place where their bondage was ended. They were free. They were being hunted down and chased to be returned to bondage, weren't they? And the bondage was ended when they went across. How come? The people trying to enslave them again were what? Dead, that's right. While the Jordan crossing, note the difference, the Jordan crossing began the second generation's appropriation or the receiving of the promise. The promised land. One ends bondage. The other, when you cross over it, it begins your conquest of the promised land. So you should note immediately that these are kind of opposites in a way, aren't they? I'm going to tell you they're not opposite. What they are is they're brackets. That they're two bookends. I'm going to go further. They're two witnesses. Okay? And if I say they're two witnesses, the crossings are two witnesses of sort of the same thing, but different. If there are two witnesses, then where do I go next? I go to Revelation chapter 11. If I go to Revelation chapter 11, where do I go? I eventually work my way back to where? Huh? Kind of. Eventually, I go back to Genesis 15 and what? Two birds. That's right. Why aren't the birds divided? So these are two witnesses, two things that teach, that testify of Christ. One is for escape. One, the other provides, enables an attack. The Red Sea is a final judgment on Egyptians. The Jordan begins the judgment on Canaan. The Red Sea was at night. The Jordan River was in broad daylight. Now, Habakkuk 3 is very important here because it will tell you that they're both judgments. The final judgment on the Egyptians and the judgment on the Canaanites. It's a holy wrath, a righteous wrath in both cases. The Red Sea, all of Israel crossed and none of Israel perished. The same is true in the Jordan River. All of Israel crosses and none of Israel perishes. At the Red Sea, how's Israel doing? They excited about going across? Read the story? Tell you, I have Israel massed up on the border of the Red Sea. Not the Reed Sea. I know you'll hear all kinds of silly things, but think about how much time it takes 3 million people to walk 120 miles. Hey, how long does that take? Plus, the Pharaoh has got to mobilize what remains of his army and go after them. And they're massed up, and they got to, it takes 3 days and three nights, by the way, just as a clue. They're following the Passover pattern. That tells you right there. All you have to do is think about how long it takes 2-3 million people to travel 120 miles to get across the Red Sea, and you have proven that it is impossible for Christ to be crucified on Friday. That doesn't make any sense to you. See me later. At the Red Sea, Israel was full of fear and unbelief, the first generations. Here's what they said. Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die? Because they saw Pharaoh's army coming towards them. And they said that to Moses. Exodus 14:11. Let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians, is what they said. In other words, we're going back. We're going back to Egypt. We want to serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better to serve the Egyptians than we should die out here. That's what they said to Moses. Moses said something really profound back, as you would expect. First generation of Israel, very afraid, ready to go back into bondage, into slavery, into death in Egypt at the hands of the Pharaoh and the Egyptians. And Moses said this. Be still, shut up. Okay, he didn't say it exactly that way, but here's what he said. Do not fear, or fear not. It's one of the great fear nots in the Bible. So what should you do, by the way, with all the fear nots? Yeah, collect them all. You should have a fear not collection. Are they going to be related? Yeah, baby, they are. Whenever God says fear not, pay attention. Fear not, stand still, and see Jesus Christ. That's what Moses said. Okay, I'll read it again. Fear not, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord. Salvation is translated how? Yeah, Yeshua, which we translate how? Jesus. Stand still and see Yeshua. Hold your peace. That's the shut up part. Be still. See the salvation of the Lord. See Jesus Christ. Shut up. The opposite was true at the Jordan. The second generation was believing and obedient and charged. One is trembling and frightened and wanting to go back into bondage and slavery and death in Egypt and mouthing off and murmuring and attacking Moses and saying, you're going to kill us all, you idiot, which they said to Moses all the time.
So you want to be a pastor, do you? The other generation was believing and obedient. All of the first generation who witnessed the Red Sea, who witnessed the salvation of the Lord, perished in the wilderness with the exception of Joshua and Caleb. What does Caleb mean, by the way? Yeah, specifically Gentile dog. Cool. That'd be who? That'd be us and a new one. I always appreciate people that name their dog Caleb. Dog, dog. Just call him redundant for short. Joshua just so happens to be, and if you're named Caleb, by the way, wonderful name. Dog does good. First generation who witnessed the Red Sea, all of them perished in the wilderness with the exception of Joshua and Caleb. And all of the second generation stood on perished ground. None of the first generation stood on perished ground with the, none of the first generation stood on promised land except Joshua and Caleb, and all of the second generation got there. The Red Sea, the waters were divided, the Jordan River, they were stood up in a heap far away at Adam. Some drained away. I may have two heaps versus a division. The Red Sea, Israel saw dead Egyptians all upon the seashore. Pharaoh's army who had pursued them to kill them, who were, notice, how afraid is the Pharaoh that compressed him to Chicken King? How afraid is the Pharaoh? He's coming after him. That's one of the great, what is he thinking in all of the Bible? I mean, he's just gone through 10 plagues. 10 plagues, he's got all the firstborn dead, his own firstborn dead. By the way, we think Tutankhamun, King Tut, firstborn dead. Study that, you'll probably have that, that's fun. They still don't know what killed King Tut. I have a guess. By the way, what was Moses' name? Tutmosis. His half-brother, Tutmosis II. We think this is Tutmosis III that is the Pharaoh here versus Tutmosis I. King Tut. That was free. Anyway, Tutmosis, Pharaoh Tutmosis is chasing after his stepbrother, if you will, adopted brother Moses. After Moses had pretty much wiped out his whole country with 10 plagues. What's overhead? Yeah, man, we're talking about, we got a flying aircraft carrier. I mean, what are you doing? He was unafraid. He even says so. I'm going to go get him. I'm going to bring him back. I'm going to kill them all. I'm yay me. Charge. Off he goes. A complete, total. Yeah. Yeah. It's insane. And that really, by the way, tells you what happens to people as they harden themselves. They become insane. Anyway. The Jordan River, the Canaanites were the opposite of Tutmosis. They were melted and trembling. Think of what the Gibeonites did. They come up with this cool plan to surrender. Israel saw dead Egyptians upon the seashore at the Red Sea crossing. What did they see at the Jordan River? What is the contrast or the comparison with the dead Egyptians? What did they see? They saw 12 stone memorials. So what is the meaning of these two witnesses, the Red Sea and the Jordan River? Both passed through, if you wish to think of it this way, both Israels passed through the water of judgment that are parted, restrained by God, Christ. They walk through on dry ground. They're safe on the other side. In both cases, they sing songs of praise. You may not know that, but the song of praise for the Jordan River is Psalm 114. For the song of praise of the Red Sea is Exodus 15. One, the Red Sea, they cross on the feast day of first fruits, the exact same day that Christ resurrects himself. Note how I say that. Christ resurrects himself. He does.
He has the power to resurrect himself. He's also resurrected by the Father and the Holy Spirit. The entire triune Godhead is involved in the resurrection of Christ. The other one, the Jordan River, is on the 10th day of the first month. What happened on the 10th day of the first month? The Red Sea is on Resurrection Sunday, what we would sillily call what? Easter. But it's really first fruits. The other one is on the 10th day of the first month. What day is that? What happened on that day? What did Christ do on that day? He rose on the very day they crossed the Red Sea. He enters on the very day they cross the Jordan River. One is Resurrection Day, the other is Entry Day. What is the number one position of Entry Day in the eschatologists? Who are the eschatologists? They are the guys that sell you books about what? Well, on end times, and they sell you books specifically about what end time event? That's right, the tribulation or the return of Christ. Number one view. I feel like Family Feud sometimes. If that makes sense to anybody but me, you're becoming weird. And back to Bill's profound question. Okay, return day, the return of Christ. But clearly this is a Passover pattern. He's using the crucifixion week to teach you why he's going across the Jordan River on the day he did and why he is resurrected on the day he resurrects. It's all based on the Passover week. Many see both Advents, and I'm going to really hustle now. Many see the first Advent and the second Advent. They see the coming in mercy, and they see the returning in judgment. Okay? The saving of the lost, coming in mercy for the lost, the unbelieving, if you will, saving them out of bondage, and coming in judgment to condemn those who refuse salvation. Returning in judgment with the circumcised, if you will. Okay? That's very common. One thing that occurs here, as you read the eschatologist, one thing that occurs here is the manna stops. As soon as they get into the Jordan River. Obviously, both crossings are portraits of Christ. Both teach of resurrection. Both teach of salvation from sin, death, and judgment. One is for those who die in the wilderness, saved. But here's the application. You say, who says I never do applicational sermons? Here we go. The Red Sea is for those who eventually die in the wilderness. They are saved. They get through death and judgment and sin. They make it across. They're blocked from going back to bondage. They can't go back to death. There's your eternal security doctrine. But they are what? He put a Red Sea. You don't get to go back. You can't lose your salvation. But you're still a sniveling whiner that's disobedient, aren't you? Remind you of anyone. They're saved, but they have no strength. They were disobedient. They were rebellious. They were weak. They did not run the race. They fell in the ditch. But they were what? Circumcised. That's right. Christ crucified. The other charges across the Jordan River. One escapes, but only escapes. The other victorious. The other generation prevails, moves forward in faith. Let's finish reading this. This sums it up really well. Numbers 13. Numbers 13, 31. Let's start at 30 because we get Caleb in it. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses. Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. Who's he talking to? The first generation of Israel. They sent spies in there, didn't they? Spies came back and said, forget it. Have you seen these guys? We have no hope of taking this land. We're in massacre. Caleb quieted the people before Moses. Let us go up at once. Let's attack. Take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. That's why he lives through the wilderness. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we are. You've got what? You've got a pillar. You've got a pillar of cloud? And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. God calls it a land of what? Flowing with milk and honey. They come back and say, no, this is a wicked land. All the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants. The descendants of Anak came from the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. And they refused to enter. So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night, and all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if we had died in the wilderness, why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not have been better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us choose a new leader and return to Egypt. That, by the way, is a tribulational event. Let us choose a different Christ and return to death. Joshua 2:24. And they said to Joshua, truly the Lord has delivered all the land into our hands, for indeed all the inhabitants of the country are faint-hearted because of us. First group is crying and weeping and trying to kill Moses. And they escaped, by the way. Could they go back? They couldn't go back. What did God do to them? He killed them in the wilderness, baby. There's your lesson. Want to go back? Don't like your salvation? Want to be rebellious and sniveling and cause problems in church? Don't attend the Sunday after Super Bowl? Is that what you want? You better read that story. You're going to die. Is there a New Testament complement of this, by the way? There is. Judgment unto death in Corinthians. It's serious stuff. I tried to make it funny. Let's rise and be dismissed.